Chapter 28
Continued.
I would like to say that Orange Will had been wrong about me. In the months that followed our meeting, I thought often of his prediction, and just as often dismissed it as ludicrous. But in less than 18 months' time, I found myself chewing gum and swishing mouthwash on television. It was a fast and steep descent that started with the sudden loss of my position with the LAQ, the budget for which was, apparently, not able to accommodate assistants with their own ego-challenging editorial opinions. I set out to look for similar work, but had no success. And as my already paltry financial reserves dropped lower, so did my standards. My mother repeatedly offered me a stipend, which I repeatedly refused. I knew that several years earlier, my father had arranged the loan for my brother's home, paying the bulk of the down payment. I remember, too, having an ugly mixture of contempt and envy for David, who was able to accept the help without any apparent reservation. For better or worse, it was not a debt I could bear to incur. Months of poverty and depression and self-pity followed. Mine is not a rags-to-riches story of drugs and prostitution and the violence of urban circumstance. I never lived shoeless on the street, nor took up with junkies and thieves. But I was lost just the same, and those alternative lifestyles of desperation no longer felt like the possibilities of another world, but the possibilities of my world, as though all that was but a few misfortunes away. It was a self-indulgently piteous season of my life, and as silly and unnecessary as I now know that it was, I also know how real those feelings were then. Every sense of who I was and what I was worth began to waste and decay. I kept up appearances for my mother, receiving her calls and enduring her unbroken stream of complaints about my father, his drinking, his aloofness, his cold and exclusive superiority, as though I had energy to burn. To the end of her days, she had no idea the state of my life during those years. As for the relationship with my father, it all but completely stopped for lack of attention. The geographic separation like a wooden stake through the heart of whatever was left of the father-daughter bond. At least he made the pretense of being busy when I called, as though he was in the middle of something so urgent or compelling that he needed to hand the phone to my mother before he had uttered 10 words of greeting. At least he bothered with the pretense. Pathetic as it is, I still love him for that. It was something. A pulse. Something. I was certainly no better. Determined to be both financially independent and cruelly forsaken of all support, I could not talk to my father without sounding either indifferent or angry at his existence. To make matters worse, all my mother's marital complaints roiled beneath the surface of my being. Quite inexplicably at the time, her grievances filled me with an irrational contempt for my father that was wholly at odds with my equally strong irritation at my mother for choosing to be such a willing and devoted victim. In truth, my father could not win with me, even if he had bothered to try. There was far too much unspoken and far too little forgiven. After a series of disastrous jobs, I finally went to work waiting tables at a restaurant in West Hollywood called Gomp's. It was one of those places where the signature plating effort lay in the elaborate, precariously vertical arrangements of a very little bit of food beneath drizzles of improbable color set upon large white platters. Gomp's towers of culinary pretension were a very long way away from the finger-licking, flesh-staining simplicity of the Nyama Choma and the Ugali awaiting me, years later, on a private island in the Indian Ocean off the Kenyan coast of Africa. If there is a comparison more emblematic of the differences between Los Angeles and Mombasa, I cannot think of one. It was at Gomp's that I fell in with a group of people that set me on the path. They no longer have names, these people. It has been far too long for names. I remember them like the little ghosts of memory that inhabit the playgrounds of my childhood. But I do remember that their primary ambition in the world was to act. Not to star in movies. No one ever used the word movie. But to act in film. They spoke of their calling to the craft. They all spoke lovingly of the screenplays, the treatments on which they were working. They spoke incessantly of the industry that surrounded us as if they were discussing their own families. Martin Scorsese was simply Uncle Marty, just as Robert De Niro was Bobby D, and Anthony Hopkins was Sir Tony. And of course, there was always Mother Merrill. They all loved Mother Merrill. The list went on forever. The enthusiasm of these people, their certainty of purpose, seemed to come to me by a kind of osmosis. I think I envied them until I gradually became them. They spoke so constantly of their auditions and of their agents and their opportunities. It was lost on me that they were all spending most of their waking hours working in the restaurant business, and that none of them had anything even remotely approaching a career in film. Their vision of themselves was infectious, and without a compelling vision of my own, I simply succumbed. What ultimately lowered my inhibitions against this seduction was their seemingly unanimous certainty that their path was also my path, that I was one of them, and that if I felt lost to the world, it was only because I had never given in to what they knew was my and everyone's true calling. Acting, the craft, the industry, the beast. Still, I mightily resisted Hollywood's gravitational pull, overplaying a shyness I did not have, and feigning rapturous devotion to a literary-minded career that did not exist. After many months of less than subtle pressure, I finally allowed myself to be coerced into auditioning for a national brand toothpaste commercial. I was assured that while they required mostly modeling, not acting, commercials were good gateway opportunities. Screen presence, demographic appeal, self-confidence, dramatic versatility, humor, sexuality, delivery. I was assured that all these things came through in what I was encouraged to think of as a kind of nationally distributed audition tape that only incidentally helped to sell somebody's product. "Great way to get noticed," they told me. "Problem is, most people don't have the looks. But you, Tilly." So, at the recommendation of my friends, I signed up an agent, Magdalene Sumner of the Bartholomew Group, a ridiculous orange-haired woman in very high heels and a severe, theatrically made-up face, recommended by one of the bussers. Maggie, as she liked to be called, drank too much coffee and tried much too hard to seem relaxed. She told me not to worry so many times and with such urgency that shortly into our first and only meeting, I was terrified about the very idea of auditioning for anything. I changed my mind about the whole idea half a dozen times and would have told her so had I been able to penetrate her rapid overcaffeinated monologue about the need for guidance and protection against exploitation. I filled out the paperwork, giving the Bartholomew Group a percentage of what she assured me would be a lucrative career in commercial acting. 2 days later, I found myself standing in a Santa Monica parking lot, baking in a 2-hour line with an assortment of bronze-skinned, white-toothed Amazons that made me feel like a fish among mermaids. My forward line mate, Kimmy Fontaine, a name manufactured so as to never be forgotten, had long since earned her stripes in a couple of Tic Tac ads, had just wrapped a shoot for Band-Aid, and was working hard on breaking into the cosmetic cabal. "L'Oreal and Maybelline were looking promising," she said, gleaming in the sun. "Lancôme needed to get over itself." I told Kimmy that I was looking for a product with an ironic, self-deprecating sense of humor. She smiled at me quizzically, as though I had burped at her, and then stopped talking. The audition, consisting mostly of a series of grotesque facial contortions in a room full of overlit mirrors, cameras, and well-dressed, overly serious men, lasted only 15 minutes. I was ejected unceremoniously back out into the sunlight, feeling numb and disoriented, awash in the anticlimactic residue of an experience that had simultaneously taken too much and too little of my time and effort. But excited phone calls from Maggie Sumner sent me back to Santa Monica twice that week. The parking lot lines for the callbacks were progressively shorter, and once I was back in the room of mirrors and lights, the well-dressed men allowed me to speak words and walk and move my arms in addition to making faces. Just the same, I found it all an alien and thoroughly demeaning exercise, which I endured like one endures a bad film only because the price of admission has already been paid and there is really nothing better to do with the evening. If success must give perseverance its due, then perseverance must tip its hat to the momentum of sacrifice and the power of optimistic delusion. It is natural for us to believe that the movie cannot possibly get any worse. I am still amazed that somehow, over scores of other women far better suited to the task, Kimmy Fontaine among them, I was selected to brush my teeth for America. I was stupefied, both with the process and the result. I felt I was awful in every respect. For the first few weeks after the commercial was released, I tried my best to avoid television entirely. But the advertisement always seemed to find me when I could least defend myself, sitting in a sports bar or in the waiting room of my mechanic. It started like a bad pickup line, with the slow moan of that baritone sax and the insinuating voiceover. "Going to bed? Be a good girl. Don't forget to brush. But remember, once it's in your mouth, there's no turning back." Each time I heard those words, I wanted to close my eyes and leave the room, the lobby, the pharmacy. But I was helpless to keep from looking, and suddenly, inevitably, there I was, bent over a sink in a skimpy open kimono, making autoerotic expressions in the mirror, and rapidly developing a sexual relationship with my toothbrush, unable to contain the flow of frothy, white paste. Convincingly unable. That was the acting part. It was ghastly. But I was the only one who felt so. Maggie Sumner spoke at me through my telephone in high-pitched gushes, promising to line up more work. The reviews from the crew at Gomp's were over the top, but no less genuine for their enthusiasm. I was not at all prepared for the pointed attention to my existence. My mouth, teeth, cheekbone structure, eyes, and my body generally were suddenly the subject of a fanfare I had great difficulty taking seriously. The backs of my legs, my ankles, the arch of my foot as I leaned into the mirror and licked foam off lips that I had always accepted as slightly misshapen and doughy, but that were suddenly luscious and full and classic. The breasts that I had always bemoaned as wrongly proportioned for my frame were suddenly exquisite and quintessential and heavenly. I told my family nothing of the commercial, telling myself that I wanted to see if they noticed on their own, and wouldn't that be fun when, one day, flipping mindlessly through the channels or before turning off the Columbus Nightly News, suddenly, there was little Tilly brushing her teeth. But as entertaining as that thought might have been, the real reason for the secrecy was a deeper ambivalence for what I had done and the jarring quality of the spectacle my parents might witness in the very living room in which, as an 8-year-old, I was scolded for watching James Bond on television. A character my father insisted was not intended for young children. 14 years later, I was no longer little Tilly, and brushing my teeth was the very least of what I would be doing on their television. It was the possibility that my family would never even recognize me that I hoped for the most. But they did recognize me. My mother called one night in a froth. "I can't believe it, Tilly," she kept saying, more to herself than to me. "I can't believe it." She had that oversaturated tone that works equally well at both ends of the emotional spectrum, and I could not tell at first whether she was euphoric or distraught. "Ben and I were folding laundry, and I looked up. I couldn't believe my eyes. I thought it was you at first, and then I just thought I was seeing things. But then Ben started to point and do his dance, and so I knew it was you. But Tilly, why didn't you tell us?" "Mom, I'm no prude. It's a sexy commercial. There's more to that commercial than just brushing teeth, that's for certain." "You knew that when you were making it, didn't you? That it has a sexual sort of theme to it?" "Mom, That's not a bad thing. It's just so, well, I don't know. So revealing. For television, I mean. I wonder what people are thinking. Maybe they won't even recognize you. Have you told any of our friends? I wonder if I should call people. Oh, I should call David. Your father hasn't seen it yet. God only knows what he'll think about it.
It was my mother's way of saying that she knew exactly what my father would think about it. It was 2 weeks later before I got the call, breaking the news that, after all the rumors, he had finally seen the spectacle for himself.
Well, he was upset. He had plenty of things to say about it. Got up and walked out of the room. He's downstairs, locked in that study. He's from a different age, Tilly. He doesn't accept change like we do. He has issues with sex, sexual sorts of things.
Yeah, well, look, Mom, it was his mother.
God, it was all of them. But she raised him that way. We don't have sex at all anymore. There's not much physical affection of any kind, really, but certainly no sex. I'd like to think I can still satisfy him. I'm no prude with sexual things, Tilly. I don't know if you know that. He's much more reserved than I am. It's just been a while. The last time we had sexual... Mom, please.
What?
The commercial, Mom. The commercial. Well, he just thinks he can control everything, but he can't. He thinks he can control me and you and David and the rest of the world, but he can't. And he can't accept that he can't. I think that's why he drinks so much. It's gotten pretty bad, Tilly. This is a difficult place to live sometimes. He's never violent or rough or anything like that. He's just very cold. And then, at times like tonight when he saw your commercial, he's just so angry, like waving his arms around and shouting, angry.
Let me guess, I interrupted, suddenly thinking of Orrin Twill and little Rosalie and of his prediction. He felt betrayed. He feels like I've betrayed him.
Yes! How did you know? That's exactly what he said, that he felt betrayed.
Lucky guess.
He just thinks it's the wrong path for you, honey. He doesn't see this, like we do, as a stepping stone to greater things, like acting on television or in the movies. He likes to think of himself as better than television and the movies. He's not really above it. He just likes... That's how he sees himself. You know what I mean? He thinks you're selling yourself short. He really does believe in you, Tilly. He really does.
Christ, don't let it bother you. The anger is for me, not you.
You? What did you ever do to make him angry? I know him too well. Maybe we all do. He hates that.
It's not as though my father and I had much of a relationship before I started selling orgasmic dental hygiene. It was a rare occasion that we ever spoke to each other, and even then, it was because he sometimes had the bad judgment to answer the telephone when I called. But after the commercial was released, and after it became common knowledge in my family that I was seriously considering some sort of career in show business or commercial acting, my father made a point of dropping all pretense of a relationship with me.
Oh. Hi, Tilly. Let me get your mother,
was the most I recall him saying to me during those years. Many years later, after I was nominated for my role as Katie Finn in Peppermint Grove, and before I had started On the Lion Tree, my mother threw a party in my honor, inviting a number of their oldest friends to the house for dinner. I participated briefly by telephone, not because I couldn't actually be there, but because the very thought of exchanging sentences with my father, of dealing with his disapproval and my own unresolved feelings about him, was so unsettling that I made up an excuse. The party is a surreal memory for me, even now at this considerable distance, both because I was not actually present for the celebration, and because my father and I exchanged more words that evening than we had in all the 5 years preceding it put together. He tried mightily that night to show his friends how proud he was of me and how supportive he was of my choices in life. He should have been nominated for an award himself. There were moments that night when even I believed him. Moments like when he sang out my name and asked his friends to raise their glasses in my honor. Brief and fleeting moments when I wished I had made the trip home, when homesickness wrenched my heart and I wished I had attended that perfectly ridiculous party in person. I listened to his voice and imagined that he was happy. Not just happy, but happy specifically for me, his only daughter. And for those scattered moments, I could feel the sun on my face, probably due as much to my own sublimated desire to believe in an undying paternal love as to any sincerity on his part. And yet, the moments were there, just the same, gleaming like little islands in the dark sea between us. That dark and quiet sea stretched from a time well before my inauspicious open kimonoed introduction to the public eye, to well beyond my Sundance nomination. It was as though a part of him had died. Or, at least, as though the part of him that was my father had developed an immunity to my presence in the world. As though he no longer cared to hear my voice over the distance, leaving me no choice but to boil that black expanse with my offensiveness. His convulsive disapprobation was the only sign of life I could identify, the only ripple in the dark that connected us. Perhaps that, as much as anything else, explains why I so willingly parlayed the debasement of my media debut into a string of like-toned commercials for chewing gum and mouthwash. I imagined that the sight of my magnified, overmade face on the television, chewing and swishing and spitting for all the boys, would irritate my father to the point of disgust, giving new life to the disapproval of my adolescence. It is impossible to maintain an indifference to that which we hate, and that to judge, even harshly, is to care. And as I chewed and swished and spit and bent at the waist in my underthings, I imagined that he cared. My service in the commercial wars against gingivitis and halitosis did not go unrewarded. A friend of a friend introduced me to the casting agent for a network crime drama called LA Nights. The auditions, believe it or not, were easier than they had been for the toothpaste ad, and did not require that I make unflattering faces. On the other hand, the LA Knights roles called for a bit less enthusiasm. I played in 3 successive seasons, a hooker strangled to death with her own pantyhose, a rich socialite bludgeoned and drowned in the bathtub by her lover accountant, and a college student raped by her professor and thrown from a speeding car. The last of these roles also involved acting comatose and testifying in a hoarse whisper from a hospital bed in lots of makeup and a thigh-length, not-so-standard issue hospital gown. The LA Knights got their man. I got more attention. I was not long in that narrow spotlight before Rufus Einemann tracked me down and flattered me into his spasmodically successful run as a director of cheap, over-the-top thrillers. Rufus was a 50-something German Jew with a towering frame and twinkling eyes and far too much charm for his own good. He liked to call me TJ and told me I was the next Kathleen Turner. He insisted that hawking hygiene products and sexing up hospital beds was a shameful waste of my inestimable talents.
"I have an eye for the genuine gift, Miss Jones,"
he said to me in the back parking lot of Gomp's, very late on the evening of our introduction. His face was made of strong bones, and his hair was outrageous, like a sculpture of wet sand. We stood in a rectangular splash of yellow light, stretching along the pavement from the kitchen door that had been propped open so the others could listen to us talk as they pretended to work. It was the moment of which each of them had dreamt.
"I have the eye, and you, my dear, have the gift. I can show you how to begin to open that gift. I suspect it will be long and glorious in the unwrapping, but it can start with me. I can pay you more money than you have ever made in your young life, and the world will know more about you than what you look like brushing your teeth."
His own teeth gleamed in the moonlight when he said this, and I could not help but remember Orrin Twill and the beast in the shadows he predicted would, sooner or later, be calling my name. With Rufus Einemann, formal introductions had been made. Within a week, I had quit my job, picked up my SAG card, fired Maggie Sumner, hired Milton Chenoweth, and signed a contract for my first motion picture, an urban thriller called The Geisha of 82nd Street. Geisha was the first of 3 films I would do for Rufus, all opening within 2 years. There was little in the way of variety to the roles. All my characters shared a penchant for exhibition, sexual compulsiveness, and a tragically short lifespan. If Brian De Palma was a second-rate Hitchcock, then Rufus Einemann, may he rest in peace, was a third or fourth-rate De Palma. His movies tended toward an unsettling blend of violence and sexual camp, all expertly marketed and presented in a slickly polished, imitative style that tricked you into thinking you were watching something much better than he actually had to offer. Like most every other aspect of the great Einemann, as he liked to call himself, his films left you feeling persuaded against your better instincts, cheapened, and just a little sick. None of them made much at the box office. Rufus chewed the scenery of his own life with such unapologetic relish and bombast that the media, especially the infotainment tabloid media, loved him. I was an inevitable sideshow to the Rufus Einemann publicity circus, in which filmmaking was almost incidental. We did not have a sexual relationship, as was widely reported by the tabloids, or at least not at the time they reported it. The relationship was casually and irresponsibly inferred from a photograph of Rufus and me laughing outside his Westwood home. It looked like we were arguing, and the lover's quarrel headlines seemed to write themselves. I had foolishly entertained hopes of keeping people from believing that I was sleeping with my director, a man nearly 30 years my senior. But such hopes were quickly snuffed between the thumb and forefinger of the Hollywood paparazzi, who thereafter regularly reported our relationship as a casual background appetizer, pretending to give Rufus an extra bit of dimension. Suddenly, the caption beneath my photo was, "Tilly Johns, Rufus Einemann's leading lady on and off the set." Or the decidedly less coy, "Tilly Johns, the latest Einemann plaything." The sexual relationship did come eventually, although it was short-lived, lasting just 6 months while we were shooting the last of the three films, Whispering Darkly. It was, as much as anything, a tribute to the power of suggestion that reality ended up following common assumption. It was only after many years of reflection that I realized the role of my parents in making the rumor a reality. My mother began calling me almost nonstop as the tabloids found their way into the homes of people she knew, and as they began appearing in the news racks of the same grocery store at which David and I had whined for sugared, prize-bearing cereal when we were children. All my mother's excitement for the promise of my career was instantly channeled into a grave and unrelenting concern for my reputation and for what people who knew her, my mother, would think about our family and about her parenting skills, and all sorts of other collateral damage that was all the more terrifying to her for being undefined. She was right, of course, and I assured her the stories were false and that there was really nothing I could do. "I guess we're going to have to get used to this sort of thing," became the mantra that always fell far short of genuine consolation. I asked her how my father was taking it. "Oh, you know him," she said with a tone that betrayed a rolling of eyes. "He tells me I'm overreacting. None of this is serious to him." That conversation marked the first time that I began to consider Rufus in a new light. Like magic, the tabloid gossip began to coalesce in my mind as poorly written, photo-documented prescience. The six-month dalliance began roughly 2 weeks later. It was a completely surreal experience. Our public appearances were, to me, exhilaratingly taboo, but were nothing particularly noteworthy to a media and public who had made the affair old news before it had begun. The irony was that the relationship got far less attention when it was for real than when it had only been imagined. The sex itself was surprisingly infrequent and lackluster. Rufus seemed to like to talk about it far more than he cared to actually do it. I had had boyfriends before, most of them forgettable, except the ones that were truly awful. So it was not as though the experience suffered by some unfavorable comparison. I had never had a lover before Rufus, Certainly not anyone with a lot of money and charisma. Certainly no one who was indifferent to the exclusivity and intended durability of a romance. At least, that is what I thought I was getting with Rufus. I broke things off when the great Einemann had a small heart attack that sent him to the hospital for a weekend. He emerged from his paper gown, suddenly mawkish with life. He indulged in private weep fests in which he lamented his long estrangement from true and committed love. He had never loved, really loved, just as he had never been loved. Time was so short, and he had never committed himself to anyone. And so on. It was the wet, cloying looks of need and hope for the future that sent me packing. The hurt and shock of my sudden reversal were greater for him than I ever expected. He rapped, whispering darkly, with a sullen, awkward insecurity, wholly at odds with his public image. And I felt responsible, actually guilty, for the castration of his personality. But I like to think that if I was a source of rejection and pain for Rufus, then I was also an unwitting vehicle for his enlightenment. Within 2 years, Rufus had abandoned heterosexuality altogether. He began making comedies about Midwestern suburban angst and adopted a grandfatherly, emotionally stable persona. If Rufus Einemann was a mistake in my life, as many have suggested, it was not for professional reasons. Paying dues in the acting business can get a lot worse than Rufus Einemann. I certainly learned something about the craft of acting. Blair Gaines told me once that he initially picked me for The Lion Tree as much for my work in the Einemann films as for my role as Katie Finn in Peppermint Grove. This perplexed me greatly, for I had no illusions about the quality of the Einemann movies. He told me that good films make for bad proving grounds. Too much support, a talented cast, a great director, a terrific script, makes it hard to see the raw talent. Difficult to focus on the qualities of a single flower in a lush garden of color.
"If you want to see the real guts of an actor, Tilly John,"
Blair said to me, lying naked on the floor gripping a bottle of red wine,
"make her the lead in a shabby movie and see what she can do with it. See how far she can drag the dead weight of the bloody thing through the muck of bed writing and crappy production, all on her own."
Something in me shone through those horrible films, and Blair had picked up on it. Professionally, Rufus was not a mistake. The more interesting question is whether Rufus was a mistake for me personally. But I cannot evaluate inevitability in terms of mistake and success, terms which assume a degree of choice I simply did not have in the matter. Rufus was inevitable. He was a scheduled stop on a bus route running from my father to Blair Gaines to Angus Mann. Rufus, or someone like him, was preordained from the time I wanted fish as a little girl and came up disappointed. There was a commotion behind me near the corner of the observatory. I turned in time to see 4 teenaged boys pretending to examine the trunk of a nearby tree. One of them was looking inexplicably into a flowering bush. They were all trying hard not to laugh and were elbowing each other as they worked on their inconspicuousness. I had developed a sense of when it was time to move on. Soon there would be others, bolder, and with lots of questions and things for me to sign. I stood, brushed the dirt off my shorts, and jogged past them through the parking lot, reconnecting with the trail that wound back down through the trees into the depths of the park. A wind had picked up, carrying with it the olfactory essence of Greater Los Angeles. I could see the sky mottling with the possibility of rain off to the east. When I reached the car, I took stock of my emotions and told myself that I felt a little better. The exercise had subdued my angst and reinvigorated my sense of purpose. I grabbed a bottle of water out of the trunk and the price point script out of the front seat and headed back for the Hanging Gardens to read while the light was still good. I found a picnic table beneath a large tree with long, elegant branches that arched out over the grass. Conical, hot pink flowers hung like ornaments. On the opposite side of the garden, a couple and a preteen daughter were pulling food out of a backpack. Two younger boys, one theirs and the other clearly a friend, raced out of the foliage into the clearing. One chasing the other, shouting and waving their arms as though pursued by angry bees, they nearly knocked the girl over before disappearing again out of the clearing and up the trail from which I had come. The woman looked at me apologetically and shrugged. I shrugged back and smiled just enough to show that I was unperturbed. But it had been too much of a smile, a little too encouraging or friendly, for the woman's look lingered and she whispered to the others. The man and the girl each rotated at the waist, turning for a good look. I looked back. What I saw was a father and his daughter turning together, reorienting in unison, twisting at the torso as they sat on the ground, turning to take me in as just another in a long parade of things of mutual interest in the world, as though they were tuned to the same frequency. Inexplicably, I found myself staring directly through their bodies into the foliage behind. Only it was not the greenery of Griffith Park I could see, but the deep foliage of Licking County, Ohio, along the shores of Buckeye Lake. I could see my parents unloading the camper with the help of some of their friends, including Rhonda Davenport, thin and vibrant, and her beloved, irascible Jack, who was then still many years away from abandoning her for the afterlife. I could see myself, as though from some omniscient perch, sitting on an old basswood log at the edge of the beach, sulking for having been forced to come, while David had unfairly escaped to be with his friends. The log stunk like rot, like something had died inside of it, I didn't care because that was how I felt, rotten and dead inside. I could see myself sitting on that dead tree, glaring daggers at the adults, begrudging them every happy moment. I sat on the dead log holding Ben by the wrist out of fear, my mother's, not my own, that he might suddenly decide to fling himself into Buckeye Lake and drown. I looked clean through these people, the man and the girl who was probably his daughter, and the woman with her hands in the backpack, and I saw deep into the trees behind them to a place where so many years ago, my parents were drinking and cutting up with the Davenports around a pit of fire, circled with gray cinder blocks, with the tape player from the camper blaring the best of Motown out into the dark woods of Licking County, sprawling around the lake that was like wet silver in the moonlight. I took Ben across the clearing to the tent where our sleeping bags were waiting, already unrolled. I watched the others through the open flap. Rhonda and my father were giving each other dancing lessons, as everybody laughed and made fun. I could see the way my father held Rhonda's hand and spun her in the firelight, and swiveled his hips to the music as though he was showing us all a thing or two. As though beach dancing was suddenly his specialty. They had all learned to leave me well enough alone, keenly appreciating that nothing would come from forcing me to participate, and that I was better left to sulk and to babysit Ben. My father had tried, anyway, waving me urgently out of the tent and into the lit circle, but I would not budge or respond. My mother and Jack, next to each other in the dirt, turned to look back at me in unison, rotating at the waist. But I stared through them into the fire without acknowledging. I saw my father give up on me with an exasperated gesture, the back of his hand as if at a mosquito, then turning his back to spin Rhonda around again in the flickering dust, as the Marvelettes sang about there being too many fish in the sea. I thought about how I had never gotten the fish, the red betta and the blue betta, my father had promised me years before, and that had been the point at which he became a different man to me, the point at which everything had begun to change. Rhonda laughed and fell to the ground, and then he on top of her. And they all laughed uproariously except for me, lost in the budding revelation that I was not merely angry with my father, but that I actually hated him. And my mother, who was laughing so hard she seemed desperate for air, frozen in mid-scream, was so pitiable to me that my feelings for her were barely more charitable. I saw myself crying and wanting out, out of the tent, out of the woods, out of their lives, wanting to walk or hitchhike or hijack the camper, whatever it took. I stared through this man and his daughter, past their blue backpack and off into the trees and bushes beyond. And I could see my brother, fast asleep in his sleeping bag, stirring next to me in our tent. He sat up slowly in his little Winnie the Pooh pajamas, his undersized head wobbling on his shoulders, his mouth open in his typically adenoidal expression, and looked at me groggily, blinking in the dim glow. The camp was quiet by then. I could hear frogs and a bird, and something splashing in the water across the lake, and whispering from a tent across from where the campfire had once raged, but which by then was only a dull orange stain in the darkness. Without a word, and with an understanding I still cannot fathom, my brother locked his arms around my neck and kissed my face sweetly, slowly, again and again. Not the skin of my cheeks so much as each particular tear, soaking them in like the earth takes the rain.